Hi, so today on our podcast, we're going to be speaking about organising precarious workers and organising in Deliveroo and the lessons to be learned from the past years of organising in that sector. We have Jack Hannon-Pearson, who used to work for Deliveroo in 2016 and 2017. During that time, he organised amongst his colleagues as within the union IWW. But was eventually threatened with dismissal during his organising drive amongst some of his co-workers. We also have on the show Ed Maltby, that was a volunteer organiser for the IWGB and has been organising in Sheffield for the past couple of years. And he's also helped develop an organising committee of workers there. We'll also be joined by Ed Potts, and I'm Imogen Woods, and we're both editors for the Prometheus Journal. So I want to welcome Ed and Jack to a podcast on organising within Deliveroo. So Jack was organising Deliveroo as a rank and file worker in 2016 and managed to organise a strike, while Ed has been organising within Sheffield within Deliveroo in the past couple of years. I just wanted to have a chat with you guys about some of your experiences as organisers, both as rank and file and sort of from outside. Go on, Jack.
Sorry, predominantly 2017, and I wouldn't. I mean, we can get into it properly later, but I wouldn't say that we organised a strike.
I thought you did.
Well, we were all sacked, so it's hard to strike when you're sacked. But we did lots of stuff that we can talk about, but that's probably not the accurate information.
Okay, I'll
Sorry.
start from the top. Okay, so yeah, I want to welcome you to Prometheus podcast about organizing on Deliveroo. And I want to welcome Jack, who organized in 2017 within Leeds as a rank and file worker. And I want to welcome Ed, who's been organizing delivery workers within Sheffield for the past couple of years. So I thought it'd be really good if you could kind of give a little brief overview of like organizing within Deliveroo and like, you know, a story about how that kind of happened and what you've been up to. If you want to start with Jack.
Yeah, thanks. So as you said, I worked for Deliveroo from kind of mid 2016 through 2017, and kind of throughout that period, multiple different kind of issues began to arise, and with my colleagues, we started to unionize through the Industrial Workers of the World, around issues around the pay, around recruitment, lots of other kind of things to do with our working conditions as well. In the course of that, six of us were essentially sacked as much as you can be when you're kind of officially self-employed. We lost all of our income, and then eventually kind of organized to get that back amongst other victories, including a recruitment freeze, postponements of some of the changes they were trying to make to our pay, more formal communication, lots of all of these types of things.
And how about you, Ed?
Yeah, so in spring 2018, first of all, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. I like Prometheus. In spring 2018, the Sheffield branch of the socialist group Workers' Liberty organised a public meeting about transforming the unions. And Greg Howard and Will Bossman, who are two activists with the IWGB, the Independent Workers of Great Britain Union's couriers and logistics branch, and both of them cycle couriers, they came and spoke at it. And out of that, a group of activists in Sheffield decided, right, we're going to start distributing the IWGB's newsletter, which is called Puncture. And it was a really nice glossy thing that came out regularly, one side English, one side Portuguese. And we would distribute that on West Street, hanging out around KFC, which got a lot of traffic from couriers, And we just chat to people about the issues that are described in that bulletin. We'd kind of read it and discuss it beforehand to educate ourselves about what people were going through. We'd hand it out and we'd say to people, and we'd do a little insert. We made our own insert that we put into that bulletin, inviting people to a meeting upstairs in the Rutland Arms. We thought, look, we're not going to, this is kind of a good thing to do, like for our immortal souls. Like, it's just something we're doing, like to be kind of virtuous socialists. We're not going to get quick results from doing this, but it's good to distribute this literature. And then like 3 weeks in, our first advertised meeting at the Rutland Arms, we thought no one would show. Actually 10 drivers show up, and they all know each other. They're all kind of organized in a friendship group with a WhatsApp group. And they've been chatting about what we've been saying and the stuff in our leaflets, and they reckon it's time to have a union in Sheffield. And from then on, I have been doing quite a lot of work assisting those guys forming a union. And there have been a series of strikes, some of them pretty big. There are now 80 members of the IWGB here in Sheffield. There've been all sorts of adventures along the way. I mean, where we're at the minute is kind of developing a renewed leadership team, because you get a lot of turnover in the industry, and some of the reps who were leading beforehand have left for various reasons. And the circumstances of their departure is also worth discussing, actually. I should also say, before I go on any further, like, I'm speaking as a trot. I'm not a representative of the IWGB in any respect, although I am a registered volunteer. And I want to give a shout out to the IWGB's registered volunteer program idea, because I think it's actually a really good thing for trade unions to do. It's like very clever. So yeah, that's where we're at, and we can get into some of the story from there, I guess.
Yeah, something that I find like quite interesting from what you've said is about like forming a union within Deliveroo. That's going to look quite different to forming a union in a more sort of traditional workplace. And like, what did that mean when you were both organising? When you've been organising?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that for us, at least, especially to begin with, it probably didn't especially. I mean, we had there was a huge advantage in that we had a shared space in the centre of Leeds where we would all sit and wait for orders to talk to each other, which was free of management. And because of the issues of over-recruitment that Deliveroo were kind of engaging at the time, we didn't have any, like, we had very little work. So we were sat around moaning about how we weren't earning any money. But the shape of the organising was, I think, almost very traditional. Like, we recruited people to the union until kind of Deliveroo forced our hands by sacking us. We were really just in kind of engaging casework of other colleagues who were being sacked, starting to like trying to formulate some bigger demands around improvements in the conditions. But we still had a manager. It's just we didn't see them, which just gave us space to kind of to do that organizing much more freely.
And Ed, you mentioned that obviously your literature would be half in English, half in Portuguese, and obviously that says something about the background of a lot of the people that you're trying to recruit and organise. So tell us a bit about that, maybe, and also just generally, both, you know, who is the typical delivery rider? Where have they come from? Do they have any experience of being in a union? Positive or negative, you know, who are the people that you're trying to organize?
So I think, yeah, I can only really talk about the workforce in Sheffield. And another theme that I want listeners to take away from this interview is I'm really stupid am bad at what I do, and I don't really know very much. And yet, in spite of that, I've been able to, you know, be of some service to this group of workers. And so if you're listening to this and you think that you're stupid and you don't know very much, like, you can definitely do lots of good organizing as well. So all I really know about is Sheffield. I know outside of Sheffield, there are lots of groups of Portuguese-speaking migrant workers. In Sheffield, the workforce is not on bikes by and large. Like, you will get bikes a little bit now and then, but that's always, that fluctuates. And the core workforce in Sheffield is made up of almost entirely migrant workers. There's one white Brit in the union, or maybe two white Brits in the union, and one Western European immigrant, a woman from France. But apart from that, it's all guys, and they're all from various migrant backgrounds, mostly in East Africa and Yemen, but there's other groups as well. And they all drive cars. So people are driving the cheapest possible cars to run. I won't name any brand names because I don't want to do free advertising on your pod, but like, they bear the costs for fuel, insurance, all the vehicle related costs. But without a vehicle, you know, I mean, without a motor vehicle, if you're just on a bike, it's very hard to get jobs. And that group of mostly East African and Yemeni and other first generation migrant workers driving little cars, they're working like sort of 70 plus hours a week is the core workforce. And there's probably between 100 and 300 people like that in Sheffield. And that number goes up and down, but there's always a core of about 100 people who are doing it really, really full time. And people tend to organize by linguistic group. So that's how basically once one of the kind of one of the more respected drivers in the Yemeni group of drivers who work in Sheffield city centre got a leaflet and he said, okay, yeah, we're going to do this. The result was all of his mates who are mostly Yemenis and other Arabic speaking, peninsular Arabic speaking drivers piled in because, you know, they're all friends and circumstances have driven them together. But there are other linguistic groups around Sheffield as well. And it's important to develop a collective leadership where, you know, everyone's represented, and everyone can hear the union message in the language in which they're most confident speaking. And yeah, so the first kind of clutch of reps, I think one guy had been a bit of a lefty back home, and another guy had lived in Britain for longer, and he had been a member of the RMT working at the train station. And he kind of carried that over. And that union culture was a really big help in the early stages of building the union. But yeah, like, you know, a lot of the people, the people who are involved in the union have life stories that involve, you know, involvement in big social movements in other countries. I think sometimes people have, some people are super aware of the possibilities of political repression because of the context that they're coming from. So some people are sometimes more conservative about like putting their face on TV because, you know, they come from a political context in which, you know, that can spell really bad news. Yeah, it's very interesting to see how everyone's different kind of political culture and trade union culture interacts in this new context where everyone finds themselves.
So yeah, go ahead, Jack. Do you want to tell us a bit about Leeds and you know, the people working for Deliveroo in Leeds?
Yeah, so the thing that's exactly the same as what Ed was saying is that there is a core, or there was at least a core group of workers working very long hours, which were sustaining the service, like through the day, through the periods of time where it wasn't, you know, where the potential for earning lots and lots of money wasn't there. So not just, obviously the image that Deliveroo tries to paint of this is that it's an incredibly flexible workforce that are dipping in and out, so, you know, possibly supplementing other forms of other sources of income. The reality in Leeds, it's slightly smaller numbers, was that there was kind of 40-ish of us who were working full-time jobs in, you know, kind of all through the day in order to sustain that service. Demographically, it was very mixed, to be honest. It was almost all men, almost all young men in their 20s and 30s, because it was, you know, it was by and large bicycles, and that was really it. At that point, cars, you weren't allowed to drive a car. There were people who were sacked for driving a car in bad weather. It was bikes, and then there was, I think there were 7 motorbikes in, you know, in the entire city. But in terms of drawing any kind of further like conclusions from the demographics, that core group was just young people from varying backgrounds, you know, people fresh out of university, other people who'd come out of prison and that was the job that they could get. I'd say the one other unifying thing is that didn't really have anyone to support. It was like you were just supporting yourself. That was the amount of money you could make. And from the brief amount of time I've spent speaking to those workers in Sheffield that Ed's been organising with, I'd say, I mean, Ed, you might want to correct me on this, but I'd say that has changed, is that it seemed like lots of those people did have families and were a bit older and, you know, had kids to support and all that type of thing, which obviously it just certainly changes the dynamic.
Yeah, so, I mean, look, one thing is the money on Deliveroo used to be a lot better. Like, you talk to anyone who's doing Deliveroo now and they'll tell you that the money for, over the course of the pandemic, actually, has just been a joke. None of the full-timers in Sheffield. So when I started doing this organising with the others back in 2019, Deliveroo was the app where you would make most of your money. If you were doing any amount of work on Uber Eats, you would sort of be laughed at because it was regarded as like real bottom of the barrel. And some people were doing a bit on Stuart, which didn't take many people on. It had its own problems, but the money was like quite good. Now, Deliveroo has gone from being the mainstay of most people's, you know, what they're making. It's right down at the bottom. And people who are doing this full time, who are trying to support a family and you know, run a car which they're driving around in for 80 hours a week, which is like wild. They are doing Uber Eats. More and more people are relying on Uber Eats and Just Eat. And we can get into the details of exactly what's going on with who's doing deliveries for Just Eat. It was Stuart. They're now moving to some sort of agency model. And I should say a word about the difference between agency employment and LIMBY worker status, if we get on, which may interest Ed as a lawyer, but, you know, it's technical, but it's quite important. But yeah, so one of the guys who represents Sheffield workers in the media quite a lot is a guy called Dee. He's taken a step back from kind of Deliveroo activism. He's now moved on to another job, another delivery-based job. And he's been the chair of the branch and has really built it from the ground up. A very, very important person in the story of Sheffield delivery workers getting organised. He started out as he was the manager, possibly the area manager of some pizza chain, Domino's possibly. And he went from that to doing Deliveroo because the money was so good. And he actually got loads of his mates to make the same switch because the money was really good. And it looked like a really good prospect, a really good way of doing a full-time job and making some money. and then Deliveroo pulled the plug on the money. You used to get a minimum of £4.25 per delivery, and that is now certainly a maximum, I would say, most of the time you're working on Deliveroo. And yeah, so lots of the core people who have been the most serious, like long-standing members of the union, are people who've got families, who've got kids, and that's tough. We did a campaign around the termination of one of our members, Khalid Khalil, who became quite well known, and he's got three kids who were being supported by doing this work, which was suddenly taken away from him. I'm sure Jack can say something about the nature of the casework you're doing with these unfair terminations. But the fact that these companies work on this spurious self-employment model, it means that they don't have anything like an HR department. And if there's any kind of complaint about you, you know, your job is on the line immediately.
I think this leads us quite like nicely on to talk about union busting within Deliveroo and what that looked like, because you've sort of briefly talked a little bit about how management is very different within Deliveroo. You're being managed by an app rather than, you know, a HR department. And you've also spoken a little bit about the fear workers experiencing being a little bit different to, you know, a sort of a workplace where it's a bit more face-to-face and you have a physical boss. So I don't know if Jack, you wanted to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, first thing to say on the management thing is, for us at least, and again, this might have changed, is we were very much being managed by a person, and like we knew who he was, and we knew who his boss was, but we just couldn't get in touch with him. He didn't give out his phone number. He was very kind of infrequently in the office that they did have in Leeds, which was just like a little box room. The way that we were communicated with in Leeds was over a WhatsApp group, which had, I can't remember what number that is, but it had the maximum number of people a WhatsApp group could have in at the time, like 160 odd. There were at least another 100 delivery riders within the city that just there wasn't space for on this group. There was no other formal communication. So everything was rumors, whether it was they're going to change the pay, whether you were allowed to work for other companies, because, you know, as Ed was alluding to earlier, one of the ways that you sustain your income is by kind of being registered with a few of these different companies. Now, the rumors that were going around at the time for us is that if you were found to be working for like Uber Eats or someone, that was it. You were out at Deliveroo. I was looking back through our demands at the time, and a lot of it was around that type of stuff, like formalization of communication. We were told, you know, there was rumors going around that we weren't allowed to take a break at any, you know, we were working 12-hour shifts, that if you wanted to take a break, you had to kind of not schedule as long working. So there was all this stuff, and it was kind of, they were controlling you by withholding clear information. And then in the same way, in terms of the busting, what they were able to do with us, because, you know, as Ed's talked about a bit, the model for delivery is always changing. And this like kind of prototypical gig economy model that I think most people think all delivery workers are on, where you log in and out where you want, how much money you earn is just determined by the rate, and they manipulate the rate to ensure more or less drivers log on. That wasn't the case for us. We were scheduled in. We had to book on for certain hours. So all of us had like anywhere between like 40 and 80 hours scheduled into our calendars every week. And the busting was that we woke up one morning and that had just all disappeared. But because they say you're self-employed, there's no kind of legal recourse to say how can you do that? Yeah, I don't, and also you can't communicate with them. All you can do is post a message in this WhatsApp group or kind of email a generic kind of national customer service type email address. So that was very much the tone of it. I don't know, is there anything else you want me to elaborate on there?
So yeah, from what you've just said, what I'm kind of interested in is how the union busting like affected your colleagues and affected their confidence organising within a union.
Yeah, so I think, well, I guess first thing to say is that there was like a steady stream of people getting sacked around that time, which was a bit of a new phenomenon. And there was this sense that Leeds management had gone a bit rogue and got a bit kind of power hungry. So there was this underlying understanding that you could lose your job at any minute, which was affecting everyone. Like people lost their jobs for going and visiting their mum in hospital and all really kind of dark stuff. I guess in terms of how it affected our organising, I don't know, because we were so, all of us doing it, this was the first time we'd ever attempted to organise in any context. And so when we encountered someone that didn't appear very interested, we just moved on to the next person, really, in terms of trying to persuade them to join the union and get involved. Looking back, there was some, you know, a couple of the trainers, like the people that would take on new staff, who worked huge numbers of hours and were very reliant on all of those hours to make ends meet, said that they supported what we were doing, but they didn't want to get involved. And now, like, as a more experienced organizer, there would be people I would be targeting and trying to understand how to get past that, which we just didn't really at the time. We just kind of continued with the group of people who were interested. There was enough of us. But in terms of the sustainability of what we were doing, having those very influential workers who were taking, you know, who were having interactions with every new person who joined Deliveroo would have been really helpful. And we just didn't attempt to get them on board beyond having those initial conversations. They said they weren't interested.
There's a couple of things I want to follow up on that, but I guess I wanted for Ed to come in a little bit and talk about how union busting affected workers within Sheffield.
I mean, to be honest, it hasn't. All right, so that's not strictly true. So Stuart is the delivery arm of Just Eat, or it was until they lost the contract, which is another story. But Stuart has what's called captains, so that's delivery workers who have a certain amount of kind of managerial responsibility over other couriers in the area. They are the point of contact for real management. They don't have hiring and firing power, but if you work for Stuart and you really annoy a captain and he's got an okay relationship with the big boss, then it's possible for the captain to get you sacked. And we heard reports of a captain in our area who's going around telling people, I don't want any of you lads involved in this union. And we sort of looked into it. I must say, in recent months, I don't know if he's moved on, found another job or whatever, there has not been any chatter about any more chatter about the captain. So I think that was probably just a one-time thing. But yeah, that's the closest thing that you get these days to an in-person manager. People are communicated with in a much more automated way now. I think that what Jack was describing in terms of you've got a little office and there's a little kind of management operation that's run out of a box somewhere in the city, that no longer applies. I mean, if you want to talk to the company, you've got to use some god-awful automated chat service in the app. You know, that has loads of drawbacks in terms of it makes your working life quite bad if every time you've got a problem, you've got to go through that. But it also means that there's just not that level of oversight, you know, that level of detailed knowledge of what people are doing. And I think the people who we choose as a group, who the workers choose to make prominent, you know, I think it's pretty clear that if they get sacked, then there's a union behind them who understands, like, you know, the legality around that. And so it seems, I think it would be more, it would be a big decision for the company to make to sack some of the kind of public faces of the union that we've got here in Sheffield. But yeah, the absence of on the ground managers is one of the really big advantages that people have got organizing in this industry. It makes people feel a lot more free to speak their mind, to attend union meetings, to handle union literature.
Yeah, just to follow on from what Ed was saying now, because I think we kind of witnessed that shift, and I think they definitely learned from the campaign that we ran off the back of getting sacked, which was very public, very kind of, you know, public shaming of Deliveroo, essentially. Since that moment, the company interacted with us in a very different way, and it was like the carrot rather than the stick. They were offering the core group of riders kind of first refusal on trials of different payment methods. They started meeting with us. They started kind of holding forums for workers, all this type of stuff. I mean, it sounds like that stuff's gone away again, but they certainly learned from, you can't just behave with total impunity. Like, that's in some ways that's actually going to do more damage than any amount of organizing a small group of workers in one city is going to achieve. Ed, you mentioned one activist that had his contract terminated in 2019. Did you say was that not as a result of kind of union busting?
No, that was a result of, like, the way the complaints process works. Someone anonymously made a complaint about him, and they didn't investigate. They didn't give him any opportunity to represent himself. I think it was, I mean, the thing that we finally, they wouldn't respond to the worker when he wrote in to say, like, what's the problem? And in fact, they only responded, I think, when we got several MPs to write to the company on his behalf. And they revealed to the MPs, not to the worker, that the complaints were about him failing to follow some element of the COVID safety precautions. So this wasn't 2019. The big sacking case was autumn 2020. No investigation, no possibility of representing yourself, no process. We've heard that we've had this, somehow, I suppose, it's about reducing liability, isn't it? You know, the company just thinks, well, we can get in less trouble if we sack people, because fundamentally we're more scared, we're more bothered about customers than we are about the workers. And, you know, yeah, I think it's very important that every case like that, you try and kick off as much as you're able, because even though they stonewall you, you want to get them to, you want to get the company to feel the weight of what's involved when you sack someone. And I think that sacking thing really gets to that. And what happens to you when you get sacked kind of strikes at the heart of this idea that you're all independent contractors, as if once you get sacked from the platform, you've got your own independent business and you'll just get back to delivering fish and chips, like, thanks to a network of restaurants that you've got on your phone through your own efforts. No, you're dependent on the platform. What I will say that I think the company's current strategy for dealing with the union is stonewalling, is refusing to engage and hoping that people lose heart. And certainly, you know, one of the conversations that we have over and over again with people in Sheffield is about how this has to be a long haul thing. We have to be building up an institution that can last for the long haul. And that this stonewalling is demoralizing, but eventually their stonewall will be broken down if we're more patient than they are.
Has the pandemic changed anything in terms of the sort of work situation? People's conditions obviously will have kind of changed somewhat, but has it changed the way that workers and management are interacting with each other? Obviously, I think it's momentarily sort of boosted delivery's profitability, hasn't it? The pandemic and people wanting to eat out without eating out, you know, when we can't go out to restaurants and so on. But it's still not really a profitable company. Has all of that changed anything?
I mean, I think the way that these companies behave towards their workers has got worse over the course of the pandemic. And I think that's because, you know, they were always moving towards a point where they'd done successive funding rounds. And I think there was pressure building, surely, to move towards an IPO. And they were probably thinking, look, for fuck's sake, surely we're going to turn a profit. Surely we're going to turn a profit during the pandemic. I think they more or less have turned a profit this year, but that's for the first time. And if they have turned a profit, it's for the first time. And it says something when your business model is only profitable if the world's governments are forcing people by law to not enter restaurants. You know, that isn't a great model. So I think they were feeling the pressure, feeling like this has got to be the year when we go into profit and we float on the stock exchange. And for that reason, we're going to turn the screws on all of these workers. And they have been turning the screws all year because I think they felt like the chips are down and they've already had $500 million off Amazon and God knows however much other money in successive funding rounds. And sooner or later, people are going to want to see something for all that.
Can I ask about how does that affect how your union kind of looks on a day-to-day basis, the fact that you've just, it's a total one-way relationship? Like, are you able to generate momentum around anything? You know, if there's no comeback.
So I think the dynamics of the life of the union are interesting because you're dealing with things on various fronts. First of all, the platforms aren't the only people that you're using union pressure against. And problems with the platform aren't the only problems that you're solving. So we have done a number of, I think the IWGB's careers and logistics branch nationally has done various experiments in how to exert pressure over the platforms. We've looked at the possibility of piling pressure on one big partner of one platform. So Wagamama I don't know if they're still exclusive with Deliveroo, but previously they were exclusively Deliveroo. Deliveroo did not want to give up that market share. So by the union just bullying Wagamama and saying, we're going to bother you until you put pressure on the platform to change or until you get tired of us and break your exclusive relationship with Deliveroo. So that was one thing that we have experimented, that the IWGB has experimented with. And then the other one, obviously, is the big strike that they did last month surrounding the IPO, which was really good and has massively built the union in a number of new places. And it was kind of a much needed structure test for the union in Sheffield. And that's really, I think that had a big effect, and people see that and they see the impact that a one day thing like that has. They see it making the headlines. They understand the pressure that's being exerted, and they think, you know, good. People appreciate that you're not going to turn over these enormous global companies after a few strikes. You know, it's a longer term thing. But I think people get real satisfaction from knowing that they're pissing them off. I think, and also, you know, the knowledge that you're building something that's going to be substantial enough to get a big change. So in terms of other targets, one really big issue in Sheffield is, right, if you're parked on double yellow lines without any other loading restrictions, then you are allowed to stop there in order to conduct loading activity. The highway code defines that as including activity away from the vehicle, which means you can stop on double yellow lines without loading restrictions to pop into the restaurant, grab your food, come out. That's loading. That's fine. But if you're driving a very small little car you're stopped on double yellow lines, very often parking wardens don't think that you're doing loading, because the mental image of a vehicle that is conducting loading activity is a Ford Transit with a sofa sticking out the back of it. And so you get loads and loads of tickets. So the union did was they approached Sheffield City Council and organised a meeting with the Parking Services Department. And we worked out a scheme whereby the union would produce signs which would be displayed on workers' dashboards, and the council would tell all of their staff, look out for these signs and understand that these guys are loading when they're displaying it. And that's something where, drivers kind of, I think drivers have like made a really big step forward on parking tickets thanks to doing that. And, you know, there's a lot of chat about, you know, make sure that you're not displaying your ticket when you're parked in, you've got to park properly when you're displaying your sign, because otherwise it's bad for the rest of us, and so on. And that's really good. Private parking companies, what I would love to do is do some sort of like mass public action campaign against some of these private firms that issue much, much bigger penalties than the council and are much less scrupulous about just hitting you with big fines for dodgy reasons, and obliging drivers for whom English is not a first language to go and make a second appeal against a ticket through POPLA or another regulatory body. It's really crap, and it costs workers loads of money. If you think about what a paltry amount of money that you will earn in an hour or even over 10 hours, and then you get hit with a parking fine for 100-odd quid because there's a faulty ANPR camera outside this KFC in a private firm that owns the land is just farming money off that, you know, that's your whole day's earnings gone out the window. It's appalling. You know, they're stealing hours of people's lives, these companies. And like, we help people make those appeals, and we do what we can to help people with that paperwork, which can be very intimidating. But what I would like to do is, you know, really get involved in some of these parking firms, get involved in their lives, you know. We also run campaigns around restaurants that treat workers badly. So I think there's an attitude in the industry that when the delivery guy turns up, he is the least important person in the room. And that's, you know, I think that is much more acute when the guy is a migrant worker who's not white, who doesn't speak English as a first language, and people, I think really some of them treat drivers with contempt in restaurants. And then even when they're not being actively rude and discourteous to people, which I think drivers feel very keenly, and the most militant strike action that's been taken in Sheffield has basically been against rudeness and almost dehumanizing treatment from certain restaurants, certain businesses. The other thing is people not using the app properly is a really big problem for drivers, because if the restaurant tells you that the food is ready now, and then you get there and the food isn't going to be ready for another quarter of an hour, you're going to get a parking ticket, you're going to get a bad review, you're going to get all sorts of issues. I mean, the other thing is you're paid not by the hour, you're paid by the drop. So if you're waiting 20 minutes, in some cases you can wait 45 minutes for a meal at some worst offending restaurants. That means that you're going to make what, £3-4 for that hour? So we've made some big, good improvements by piling the pressure on certain local restaurants and helping out with lots of casework, especially related to parking or to unfair terminations. We have been able to overturn quite a few unfair terminations. Something you get quite a lot of is the facial recognition issue. So to make sure that you are who you say you are and you're not renting out your account to your mate, intermittently, some of these platforms will ask you to take a selfie while you're driving, and they'll cross-reference that using an automated facial recognition program against your profile picture that you've uploaded to the app when you started working for them.
And no prizes for guessing what ethnicity the algorithms are trained on.
Exactly. So, yeah, so those programs can't tell black faces apart I don't want to say across the board, but certainly they have had difficulty telling black faces apart, with the result that you get people being sacked because the computer has not been trained to recognize their face properly, which is a great example. You know, there's all this stuff about artificial intelligence just reproducing the prejudices of the people who make it, and this is a really good example of that. But yeah, we've overturned a number of them. Or rather, the IWGB has overturned a number of them, a number of cases like that. And I think the platforms are aware of how embarrassing that is. So they rectify it quite swiftly, but they have not yet paid for better facial recognition software.
Can I just take you back, Ed, to something you said about restaurant owners and specifically, I think, about small restaurants and takeaways that I was interested in, because obviously, that, you know, it's an incredibly exploitative industry in itself, and were these delivery drivers working directly for a restaurant, then, you know, clearly they would be being exploited by these small business owners directly. But it's been in the news recently about the rise of what they call dark kitchens, which, you know, Deliveroo are setting up, whereby they've basically worked out that they're now big enough and they have a big enough platform that they can cut out the middleman. They don't actually need other people to run restaurants, especially if nobody's going to actually go in for a restaurant experience. And so they can just have warehouses, I think, filled with kitchens who produce food directly for Deliveroo to deliver to people. And there's been a bit of coverage of this in the press recently about small business owners, you know, aghast at this development. And I was wondering if you thought there's any kind of scope there for, you know, drawing some restaurant owners into, you know, onto the side of delivery workers, whether there's any scope for kind of using some of that as leverage against the platform owners, and what your kind of take on developments there is.
Well, I think just as a matter of kind of common decency, lots of people who work in the industry are very supportive of these workers. It is absolutely a fact that the delivery driver is the guy in the chain who is often treated with the worst contempt in this industry. You walk into the restaurant and everyone looks through you, or they just don't regard your time as important. But it's also the case that there's loads of restaurants where the staff and the managers, because often managers in fast food chains are not really managers. They're slightly promoted, slightly more skilled members of the workforce in general, are very supportive, and, you know, they have a good relationship with the drivers. I think that's true. We don't have any dark kitchens in Sheffield. I'm sure that it would be possible to build some sort of solidarity with certain restaurateurs. I know they've got a dark kitchen in Leeds, so I think it's probably best for Jack to handle all the dark kitchen question.
Yeah, I don't know. They didn't have a dark kitchen when I was there, unfortunately. But I mean, what I would say is that it's a, you know, undoubtedly it's the drivers who have been the most exploited by Deliveroo, but the small businesses are as well. Like, it's not the same relationship as they have with a company like Wagamama's, where people are signing up to Deliveroo in order to order Wagamama's, whereas, you know, like, the business model of some of these smaller restaurants is reliant on Deliveroo. At least at the time that I was working there, the percentage that Deliveroo took was different. So they took far more money off these smaller businesses than they did off big chains. They were also selling them like the tablets and all that stuff. There was all that element of having to interact with the kind of delivery infrastructure that it was a problem for us as drivers, but also was a problem for these companies as well. And I'm sure that getting any issues with that fixed was much easier for a big chain than it was for like an independent curry house. So there's a lot of shared problems there as well. I mean, it's all just making me think of the things that we should have done, because it's like the organizing opportunities are so ripe when you're talking about a workforce that are interacting with all these different kind of different stakeholders in the process. You've got like the council managing the streets, restaurants, the actual company themselves. Like for us as well, one of the biggest conflicts was with the train station, where we would try and take shelter in there when it was cold or raining, and would constantly be getting trucks out. Like, there's all just finding somewhere warm to sit if you're a cyclist. There's all sorts of opportunities to find these little victories along the way, which, you know, ideal really when you're trying to get a union off the ground.
Well, I was going to say, like, yeah, those opportunities are really ripe for getting those small wins to build confidence, to aid in like recruiting people and building the union. And I think, yeah, some of the things that you've been talking about, Ed, I was like, that's well smart, and like a really like smart way of organizing. I've definitely learned some things today, like, that I'll think about in my own organizing. So I guess what I wanted to ask you, Ed, was around, so like Jack's spoken a little bit about kind of mistakes that he made, or being a little bit sort of green to organizing, but and some of the stuff that you've talked about sounds really like great, but I wonder if there's anything that you would have done differently or changed about how you've organized in Deliveroo over the past couple of years.
I think so in terms of a mistake, like, I think one thing that's a mistake is you do something and it works really well, and so then you think that that is the answer for everything that is going to come your way. So how do we get the union started? We went and hung out on West Street and talked to drivers. Okay. Let's say the drivers come together, they elect a leadership, And that leadership starts having some difficulties. You know, they find it difficult to be the leaders that they know that the union needs. And so then you're getting into this question of how do you best support and develop the leaders of the drivers, and how do you make a really good leadership team? And sometimes my answer to that was, well, I don't know, I just do the last thing I did that worked. So I get back out on West Street leafleting drivers. Do you know what I mean? Like, rather than doing rather than answering the next question, if you did the last thing right, you keep on answering the last question. So I would say that's a mistake that I'm prone to making. Another one is that I am driven by guilt. And so I always want to do like as much as possible, organize as high tempo and as high a tempo of action as possible. And I freak out if, you know, a week or a couple of weeks goes by when I've not been like doing stuff, and like you can't live like that, you know. You can't live like that. So those are the two mistakes that I'd say we've done. And just sort of, again, I really want to emphasize this thing of like, look, the reason that I think like the reason that I went out and started handing out this literature and getting a team of people together to do this organizing work to begin with. And then the reason that I've stuck with it is political. It's because I've got a political education as a Marxist, and I've got people around me as Marxist activists who are workplace organizers, workplace activists themselves. I can bounce ideas off. I've learned stuff from. I've got experience of handing out workplace bulletins, which have been produced by other comrades in the movement. And I think that, like, basically, look, building this union is really hard, but just getting out there with a leaflet, with a few people, reading and learning and educating yourself about what's going on with this group of workers, getting out into your town centre and talking to people about it is actually, once you basically know how, it's quite easy. And that is something that the socialist movement should be doing. So, like, I'm not speaking here as any kind of representative of the IWGB. I'm speaking as an organised socialist. And I think that other socialist organisations should have a go at doing the same thing. This is a workforce which is organizing itself. You know, frequently there are self-organized strikes going on without reference to any union. So clearly this is an industry that's like in turmoil and crisis, and there's a great need for people to assist workers in organizing and for the socialist movement to do what it can to impart some of that organizing culture and knowledge to these workers who are having these fights. And I just think like it is something that anyone who's listening to this, who's in a group of socialists locally, like, you know, they should crack on basically. And I think the worst mistake is a comrade I know who's a teacher. And he's got a sign up in his classroom that says, you know, don't be afraid of making mistakes, only be afraid of having a blank page. He often brings that out at political meetings. And I think that, you know, that's the worst mistake, is not going out and doing it. And I stopped making that mistake in 2019. And basically, I think people should just get out there, learn how to do it, make sure that your socialist organization is capable of teaching you how to do it. Just go and do it. And I'm dumb as hell. Like, I'm really like bad at everything that I've done in quite an inexpert way. I have not traveled to America and done workshops with the Fight for 15 people or whatever. Like, I'm just quite bad at doing all of this stuff, and it's kind of worked. So, like, anyone listening to this, should also go out and, like, you know, do as bad a job of organizing as you need to, but they should learn how to do it and they should go out and do it.
I just want to briefly add something to it, to that. Like, I totally agree, like, people should just go out and chat to workers and organize unions, not just like as an outsider, like organizing delivery workers, but also in their own workplaces. But the other thing, it's really good fun. Like, I love going to chatting to workers about their issues and what they care about, and trying to like navigate that conversation towards like a union or a collective solution. It's just a like fantastic, like heartwarming experience to have that conversation, see a worker see their ability to have power within when they've been oppressed. But I don't know if Jack wanted to come in and say anything.
Well, I mean, I just agree with both of you, really. And I do think places like Deliveroo are just a fantastic place to learn how to do that, because, you know, I hope it's come across from what me and Ed have been saying, but the conditions are so right for it. You have the space to talk to people. It's not like, you know, I mean, both me and Imogen organize within the social care sector now, and, you know, just getting access to workers is a fight in itself. That issue doesn't exist quite so much in somewhere like Deliveroo. There's not a manager over their shoulder. You're free to. The emphasis isn't on being able to get your point across in two or three lines. Like, you're free to have a bit more of a conversation. And then there's just so many issues, fixable issues, as Ed has been talking about. You're not going to ask, "Oh, what's wrong in your workplace?" They're going to have an answer to that question. So yeah, like, absolutely, just get stuck in.
Their workplace is outside, like, their workplace is outside KFC. Yes. It's like if Amazon warehouses were all turned inside out and any random member of the public could just go and hand out union literature with no obstacle. You know, the workplace is right there. And I don't think, like, you should just, like, randomly pester workers who are trying to do their job with something that you just sucked out of your thumb. But, like, people should, in an organized way, obtain or produce literature, make a little plan amongst some comrades, and go out and, you know, crack on. Yeah,
potentially they're on your doorstep if you order a, you know, if you order a curry.
I feel like that's a really nice place to end it, but I don't know if either of you had sort of more to say.
I've got an opinion about how we should nationalize these platforms, which is
okay.
So, like, I don't think any of these platforms are profitable. I don't think Deliveroo is profitable outside of, again, like, the armed body of the state preventing people from entering restaurants. I don't think Uber Eats or Stuart are profitable either. But I'm not 100% on that. It's possible that Stuart has turned a profit. It's possible that Just Eat has. But they're, you know, they're not doing well. And Deliveroo in particular is just pouring money into this. And I think that's a bit like how it is with building roads or building schools. Like, important pieces of useful infrastructure are rarely profitable to run, in part because you need to have coverage over the dead periods as well. Otherwise, you know, you couldn't run the postal service on the basis of not bothering with deliveries when lots of people haven't sent a letter that day. So it's not profitable. You know, it's not something that the market can deliver. But I do think that, you know, these services are really, really useful. I think in what the IWGB has been saying is, like, putting a lot of emphasis on how these are key workers. And I think that there's a lot of value in putting it like that. What these guys are doing is useful. And also for people like me, for whom it's, you know, there's no element of an essential service in this. I could just go out and, like, cook food for myself if I wanted to. You just order delivery when you fancy having a takeaway. It's a really efficient service. It's really good. It gives people access to big variety. It's, you know, it, like, it's something that's decent. If only it wasn't run on the basis of like blood curdling exploitation, you know. And it's really hard for it to make a profit. But it should be run democratically, as a public service. It should be, you know, it should be run by the people who do it, and it should be run as a public service. So I think nationalize these platforms. You know, and I'm not just saying that in a jokey, like, oh yeah, nationalize Greg's way. I mean, like, you know, would you nationalize sausages? Probably not, but I'd definitely nationalize the platform that's delivering.
It was something that we kind of looked at how we could create a model that we ran ourselves, you know, kind of along those similar lines. And also just that, especially within this, the kind of cycling element of it, you know, these are jobs that people want to do the job. It's kind of a good and enjoyable way to earn a living if it wasn't for the terrible conditions. And there's, you know, there's similar to what the CWU was saying at the start of the pandemic, like around this, like the contact with vulnerable people being an essential service. There's all sorts of things like picking up like people's prescriptions, all that it could, you know, that you could incorporate to make it quite like, you know, to give people access to these essentials that are kind of forgotten about at the moment.
So.
And it's the sort of thing as well, isn't it, that not that I would necessarily, you know, promote this over, you know, nationalization or anything like that, but it's the sort of thing that could so easily give way to, with a bit of a push, you know, give way to cooperatively run alternatives and things like that, isn't it? I mean, you know, I'm thinking of like the taxis in Birmingham. I forget what the thing called, TOA taxis, that's it. You know, like a big sort of taxi collective has been run as a, you know, like a mutual effectively for years and years and years. And, you know, so with the right sort of funding in place, you know, it's easy to imagine alternatives arising to it, I think.
Imogen, sorry, I know you're trying to wrap up. Like the other, just edit it out. The other thing that occurred to me that, you know, a whole other group of people that we're not really engaged in terms of this organizing so far is the customer. And I don't know if this has changed as delivery has expanded, but I would say that the demographics of those people are probably, you know, broadly like young people with some degree of like, social kind of consciousness, that want to consume things in a, I don't want to go down the route of ethical consumerism, so but you know what I'm saying, like they do take an interest in the way that things are produced, and that's another like really powerful group of people that we could be looking at getting on board with this stuff.
I mean, so one thing that we sort of explored, but it hit a brick wall because, like, student unions now are a lot worse even than what they were 10 years ago. Or, like, maybe not all of them, but they're pretty bad. We tried to get the student unions in Sheffield to run campaigns based around sort of educating students about the issues facing drivers. So one thing that you get on a yearly basis basically is there's always a wave of customers who put in bogus complaints because they think that if you put in a bogus complaint you'll get free food. Well, you may or may not get free food if you put in a bogus complaint, but what will happen is someone will be at risk of losing their job. And we wanted to get that message out there. We wanted to help people understand about the importance of picking food up on time, and of, like, you know, the difficulties that drivers face. And getting something like that out through the students' union would be fantastic. Or even a student union, like, let's say there's a leaflet that the union wants all delivery workers in a city to get. If the students' union provides all students with just a little leaflet and say, like, you know, please give this to the delivery worker when you get your, that would be huge. That would be a game changer. So I think in terms of something that's like an organization of consumers of this service, an organization of users of this service, that already exists in the form of a students' union. And in certain areas where you've got very, very high Labour Party membership, like Wood Green, like, I think the Labour Party can do stuff as well.
I think that sounds, yeah, like a hot tip, but what was the student union's response? Like, why wouldn't they get involved?
No one said, like, you know, fuck off. Like, it just, you know, they had other things to think about, I suppose. It just...
Freshers week.
Well, look, what happens if you have an office that's... if you have an office that's not, like, functioning at a very high level, you know? It just gets lost in the office, you know? A suggestion, a request for a conversation, a request for a meeting, it just kind of dissipates like water from a hose going out into the lawn, you know? No one said, like, no, we really support the horrible exploitation of delivery work. how very dare you? Security? No, we didn't get that. It
wasn't a priority.
So that's right.
Sure. Now I'm gonna wrap up. So thank you so much, Jack and Ed, for coming on this podcast. It's been like super, super interesting, and your experiences are like really valuable, and I'm sure our listeners will get a lot from it.